about Church Street Blues.
Wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
Ooh, Rick Moore is away on vacation right now. This is Sean McCourt stepping in while he's away. Yes, he's away at Vegas, gambling away his money. It's a very special edition of the Wake-Up Call this morning. Our guest is James Hilton, Vice President at UVA and CIO. James, let's go ahead and get a check on that microphone there, make sure we can hear you.
Okay, how does it sound?
That sounds just great.
Terrific.
So I do have to make a public disclosure right at the beginning of the show. My day job is with UVA at ITC, Department of Information Technology and Communication. So you are my boss's boss's boss. I guess that would make you my great-grandboss.
Boss cubed, I like to think of it.
Okay, well, thank you for coming in today. This should be a very interesting discussion about what's going on in IT, not just at the university, but I think what happens at the university both affects what's going on in the larger community and really reflects what's going on in the larger world, because IT has touched our lives in so many ways.
Sure.
So let's start with a little bit about you, about your background, what you were doing before, what brought you to UVA, how long you've been here, and what is a CIO?
Sure. I'll try to keep this in the 30-second realm as opposed to the my life story realm.
Yeah. We'll do that another time.
So I graduated from college in 1981 from the University of Texas and then went to graduate school at Princeton University, where I got a PhD. I'm a social psychologist by training. In 1985, I joined the faculty at the University of Michigan, taught a variety of graduate and undergraduate courses, worked with a bunch of graduate students, rose through the ranks from assistant to associate to full professor, and along the way started using a lot of technology, especially in support of my classrooms, and started writing for multimedia, and started encountering problems as I did all that, because you had this conflict between sort of traditional book publishing formats and software and intellectual property policies, and I complained a lot, and I got rewarded for my complaints with a committee assignment, and I chaired a committee that was supposed to look at, this was probably right around 1999, mm-hmm. So the internet was fresh, well, the web was fresh, and
we were still typing www in front of every web address.
We absolutely were, and many of us didn't know what that meant. My committee was basically charged with looking at sort of the intersection of intellectual property and technology, particularly as it impacted scholarship. And the committee noted that copyright was very complicated, and it remains very complicated. But it said that the committee, the essence of the report said that the real conflict that's emerging is the conflict between a society where copyright interests are increasingly driven by the entertainment industry, mm-hmm. and a desire for a sort of pure property view of the world of ideas and expressions, and the academy. You know, if you think about the reason why universities exist at their core, they exist to bring together a group of people, faculty, staff, students, all in this collaborative world where we explore, create new knowledge. It's a world where we want people to share ideas. And the punchline of the committee report was that we were soon going to face a clash between the expectations that people bring from growing up in a culture where ideas seem often to be owned and the university where ideas are to be shared. And we basically said somebody ought to be looking at that up close and personal and thinking about it in a proactive way for the university. How should the university operate in that world? I got appointed after that committee to do that for the provost. I spent a year looking at those issues. It was terrific. I could be in any meeting I wanted to be in, and I didn't have to be in any meeting, and I had no clear deliverables, and I was just supposed to talk about where the university should go.
Oh, man, I think you need to recreate a position here at UVA.
Yeah, I do. And after a year of doing that, I got what I think of as the frequent administrator upgrade. The CIO at the University of Michigan left, and the Michigan decided to, because of the relationship between technology and the academic mission, decided to create an associate provost position. The provost is the chief academic officer of the university. So they created an associate provost who was going to be responsible for information technology, and that was me. And so I did that for 4 years, and then as an add-on, I was the liaison through which the libraries reported to the provost, and the university librarian at Michigan, for health reasons, decided to step down. And I was for the last year that I was at Michigan, I was the interim university librarian as an add-on to being the associate provost for IT. But somewhere along the way, I was seduced by UVA. it's probably the only place that could have pulled me away from Michigan. It's I have a bias for great public universities.
And you are a Southern boy originally, right?
I grew up in the mountains of North Carolina. So yeah. During the job interviews, they kept wanting to tell me about the area, and I kept saying, I understand the area. Let's talk about the job.
Yeah.
So it's been wonderful to come back to that. And so I came here in 2006 as vice president and chief information officer, and have been trying to stir up trouble since then.
All right. You're listening to the Wake Up Call in WNRN. That's 91.9 in Charlottesville and Lovington at 94.7. We're talking to James Hilton, vice president and CIO at the University of Virginia. This is Sean McCord subbing in for Rick Moore. So, James, before we touch back on your biography, I have to mention University of Michigan. So I seem to recall that there's another administrator from Michigan who's going to be joining the UVA family lately. Can you talk about that?
Let me see if I can think. Perhaps you mean President Sullivan.
Yes, that's the name.
Yeah, she'll be joining us in August.
Mm-hmm.
It's very exciting. It's, of course, I think, bittersweet. I came to Virginia in part because of the leadership and amazing things that John Castine has done. He is, by any metric, he is arguably the most successful university president of modern times. He's been president of a major public university for 20 years.
I know, 20 years. That's amazing.
If you look at the half-life on most university presidents, it's probably more in the four-year range.
Right.
And has, if you look at where Virginia has come over the time that he's been at the helm, it's phenomenal. And again, Virginia was probably one of the only places that could have pulled me away from Michigan because of the ambitions that this place has, partly bound in its legacy. At the same time, I think that Virginia's greatest strength, and in some ways one of its liabilities, is the legacy. We have traditions here that are strong and important, and they ground us, and sometimes they hold us. And one of the things that I think is really exciting is to have somebody of President Sullivan's breadth of experience to come into this place with a set of fresh ideas to look at how we should be moving in the future, how we take UVA to the next level. So I think it's going
to
be great.
So were you on the recruiting team to bring her here?
I was not. And in fact, I have to confess that she and I overlapped at Michigan for 1 month. My entrance interview with her was also my exit interview because I had decided before she had been announced to become provost at Michigan, I had already made the decision to come to Virginia. So we share culture and spirit, but we don't actually have a lot of contact so far.
Okay, but it might be true that she came here because she wanted to work with you again.
Actually, my assistant was serving as my assistant from Michigan was serving as her interim chief of staff the day that it was publicly announced that she was going to be the president here. And the word apparently at Michigan was it had taken my assistant 4 years to drive me to Virginia, but it only took her a week to drive Terry here.
You're listening to the Wake Up Call in WNRN. Support for WNRN is also from Specialty Guitars Plus in Charlottesville, where beginners and rock stars are welcome. Specialty Guitars Plus features instruments, amps, and lessons on guitar, banjo, bass, piano, and violin for beginners or advanced students. Consignments are welcome, too. That's Specialty Guitars Plus in the Woodbrook Shopping Center on the lower level behind 7-Eleven. More is at specialtyguitarsplus.com. All right, so we're talking with James Hilton, vice president and CIO at the university. And you mentioned that when you came here, there are traditions that are advantages, but also some liabilities. So when you came here to the university, you had some ideas, but I'll bet a lot of those ideas got totally disrupted once you actually finally started on the job. So what have you been able to, what have you accomplished? What did you come in wanting to accomplish, and have you achieved those goals, and how those goals changed in your 4 years on the job?
Well, so at the highest level, I'll never achieve the goals that I came here with, because at the highest level, the goal is, I think that technology, higher education was formed in a time that predated digital technology. And the digital technology, it changes if you look at every industry that technology has touched, it has a large and often disruptive impact on it. So think about how you did banking 20 years ago versus how you do banking today. There's almost nothing overlapping between standing in lines for long periods of time to see a physical teller, and now where you do banking online or you do it at ATMs and you hardly see anybody. Or if you think about how the music industry has been disrupted by technology, where albums, the only way music was distributed was in the form of collections of songs sold as albums, and now you have a variety of ways to purchase songs individually, or groups may decide that they have a different business model and they're going to make their songs available for free. It's totally disrupted the business and practices of the industries that it's touched. And if you think about higher education, mm-hmm. higher education is an incredibly information-intensive industry. It's sort of the core of what we do. And yet, so far, the impact of technology on education has been, I would say, minimal, much less than people would have predicted.
Well, how so?
Well, so if you look at, if it is still the case that if you walked onto almost any university campus and walked into a first-year class, my parents would recognize the form of that class. My grandparents would recognize the form of that class.
Well, Thomas Jefferson recognized.
Thomas Jefferson would recognize the form of that class. And much of what we do in universities, it seems to me, so what universities try to do, the best universities, we're in a strange business. We're in a business where what we're trying to do is to create habits of mind. That what universities strive to do is not to give you just a boatload of facts and ask you to master those facts and then certify that you remember those facts. What great universities do is they change the way you think about. They put you in a position where when you're given new facts, facts that have never been around before, that you're in a position to think about them, to think about them critically, to think about them creatively, to innovate. But much of our curriculum focuses on facts. So when I used to teach introductory psychology, and people would ask me, what was the goal for the course? The goal for the course was for people to come out of that class understanding how different kinds of psychologists, social psychologists, clinical psychologists, cognitive psychologists, how they would think about the world. They would understand the perspective, and they would understand what an interesting question was, a question worthy of more thought and action. That's what I think of as a habit of mind. But in fact, what I would do is give them lots of facts, tell them lots of stories, and I would test them on their memory and understanding of those facts and stories. Mm-hmm. And to me, that is to miss that's to miss a great opportunity. That those kinds of things are increasingly, you can think about a lot of what we do as algorithmic, and then what we live for is how do we provide opportunities for students to get involved in creative new knowledge discovery. So I'm interested in how do we find ways to use technology to make the rote part more efficient, the part that you have to have in order to become competent to speak the language of whatever the discipline is, how do we get that through faster, more efficiently, so that when you're here on grounds, engaged at a research university in the discovery of new knowledge, you as an undergraduate can be a participant in the discovery of that knowledge.
Now, there have been discussions about bringing technology into the classroom, not just how can instructors best use technology, but how to, in some cases, keep technology from coming into the classroom. And, you know, over the years, it's become clearer and clearer. I mean, we have a generation of students now who always have technology on their person, in the very least in the form of smartphones. And there have been discussions about, you know, early on it was how to keep them from being distracted, how to keep them from checking their email while they're sitting in class. And presumably the way you do that is by making the content compelling enough that they will put their phones away. But are there ways now to leverage that technology to take advantage of the fact that they're bringing their laptops, their netbooks, their smartphones with them into the classrooms and use that to advance the curricula.
Yeah, so I think a couple of reactions to that. First, I think you're right. I think that one of the things that universities and society more generally are having to answer the question again is who controls the technology. So in the good old days, when technology was new, it was for a small group of people, controlled by a small group of people. You could approach information technology, for example, at the university by saying, who's going to control the technology that comes in? And you had to rely upon the institution to provide you with the technology. So when I was an undergraduate, I worked with a faculty member and I did data analysis and I analyzed data the faculty member provided for me with software that the university provided for me on a mainframe that the university ran. So it was one-stop shopping. The university controlled it all. You know, now, if I'm a student, I actually, other than perhaps where I get the data from, I don't need the university necessarily for any of that. There are statistical analysis packages available on the web for essentially no cost. With netbook devices and web-enabled devices, smartphones, getting access to them is not a problem. So one of the things that we've been trying to think a lot about is how do you now think about education in a consumer-driven world,
right,
as opposed to an enterprise-driven world, in a world where students do come in. When I was at Michigan, at one point, one of the deans came up to me and said, I understand I was part of a group that was looking at trying to bring broadband access to the county, wireless access to the county, pervasively. And a dean came up to me and said, I understand that you're part of this group that's trying to do this. And I said, well, yes, I am. And he said, well, my faculty and I are going to be out there with bulldozers trying to make sure that it doesn't happen anywhere near our classrooms. And I said, well, why? And he said, because we have serious pedagogy problems with wireless. The notion that students would have access to the World Wide Web, that they would be checking their email, that they would be doing all those things during class. He said, those are pedagogical challenges, and we want to keep it out. And at the time, I had a smartphone, and I pulled it out, and I said, here's the problem. It's already there.
Mm-hmm.
You can't control it. So the question now for me is, how do we find ways to manage and leverage the consumer devices and tools that are coming, as opposed to how do we find ways to control and gate them? And, you know, a very concrete example of that is one of the things that we're doing at Virginia is we have public computing labs, which in the early days made perfect sense. Students didn't have computers.
Mm-hmm.
The only seats that could be provided were ones we provided, and we started putting out these public computing labs to enable people to come in and use the tools.
Sure. You had to go into the lab in order to use the engineering software or the CAD software or any variety of packages that the university provides.
Right. It was the only way to get to it. But now we know that 100% of our students come with computers. 99% of those computers last year were laptops.
Mm-hmm.
And that's before the real explosion of netbook devices. So I, in fact, imagine that when we do the survey next year, we'll find that a large number of students come with two computers. They come with a big heavy one that's going to sit on their desk, and they come with a netbook that they're going to carry around with them during the day. And so the question that we start asking is, given that they have already made this investment on all of this technology, does it make sense for the university to continue to invest in essentially redundant technology? So we started looking at how the labs were used. And while it is true that there are a small number of specialized teaching labs, which we're not doing anything to, the public computing labs, for the most part, 95% of the use of those public computing labs were for what I would call commodity, meaning ubiquitously available software, word processing programs, mm-hmm. browsers, mm-hmm. email programs. So mm-hmm. only 5% of it was for the specialized software where we still are the main gate for doing it. So we're in the process of doing two things. One is phasing out the public computing labs, encouraging students, in fact, to use the technology that they already own and bring. And we're looking at ways to virtualize delivery of the specialized software so that even the software that you have to get access to through the university, we will be able to deliver to your personal laptop wherever you are as long as you're connected to the web.
All right, and that is a whole new interesting area, and I want to get back to that. We're talking to James Hilton, Vice President and CIO at UVA. This is the Wake Up Call. If you have questions for James, you can call 979 979- 1-800-273-0919 or a toll-free number, 1-877-967-6762. You can text us at *NRN on Intellos Wireless and instant message on WNRN Studio-AOL. The markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and Shenandoah Valley. Mostly sunny today with a high 72 to 77. Cloudy tonight, showers after midnight with lows 43 to 48. Lower 50s in Lynchburg and Richmond. Then cloudy with showers tomorrow, highs in the 60 to 65, upper 50s in the valley. Currently in the valley, it's 59, 61 in Lynchburg. Partly cloudy and 65 in Richmond, and a lovely 65 in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And support today is also from Gene Theory, with a selection of new and gently used designer denim, including Joe's, Page, William Rass, Sevens, and Citizens, as well as tops, dresses, and accessories. Gently used items can be purchased up front from customers, too. Gene Theory is on 4th Street Northeast on the Downtown Mall in Charlottesville. For more info, it's 296-JEAN or shopgenetheory.com. You can also find Gene Theory on Facebook and Twitter. All right, we are talking with James Hilton, Vice President and CIO at the University. And, James, you were talking about closing the public computing labs and finding a new way to provide software to students. But don't the public computing labs also serve, they serve the public for people to come in and be able to use the labs if they don't have access to things at home? How is this – Does that make this something of a controversial move?
I think that the problem isn't the thing that makes it a controversial move isn't the access, because again, at least for the university population, 100% of people have access through devices they already own. I think that the challenge is that it's seen as inconvenience. So one of the things that it pits, if you ask me, are the public computing labs increasing in popularity or decreasing in popularity as judged by the number of people who are using them, I would say they're increasing in popularity. It's very convenient. You know, as technology, as we become increasingly wired / unwired, as we become increasingly connected through technology, it's very convenient. The demand for being able to access that keeps going up. And it's convenient to be able to leave your laptops and things at home. But the challenge that we find right now is technology budgets are not growing. At best, they're holding flat to declining. The financial pressures that higher education is under are well known. And the challenge with technology is it's always moving. There's always something next that you need to be prepared to roll in. And so our challenge is always to find how do we take resources from services that have perhaps become merely convenient now and reapply those resources to strategic investments. Virtualization is one of those strategic investments. You know, if I painted it another way and said, forget about closing the public computing labs, and I said, instead, don't you think it would be really great if we could make it so that you could get access to whatever software you wanted, wherever you were, so that when it's a cold and snowy night, you can still access it without schlepping over at midnight to one of the libraries? That's seen as a plus. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to balance out sort of convenience and strategic in reallocating resources.
Okay, and I want to talk more about those distinctions, but we have a caller right now from Harrisonburg. Caller, are you on the line?
Me?
Yes, go ahead. Sorry, your name is Esfit?
My name is Esfit, and I have a space in New York for the month of April. And I'm doing some multimedia projects, including using all these archives from my road trip through Georgia, Mississippi, Texas, Tennessee, Arkansas, and Virginia. And I would love to have, I guess, university partnerships, both for students to work on stuff and for equipment purchasing and rental decisions that I'm trying to make for this space. So if any students or even faculty or grads were interested in helping me out setting up this project. And it's probably going to be southern stuff. There's also going to be media from Chile, Israel, and Ukraine, and other countries. But right now my focus is southern radio.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm gonna take you off the air right now. So, James, our caller brings up an interesting question about partnerships with the community. Her specific area is the arts. We're talking about technology. So what kind of partnerships can the university have with a larger community?
Well, I think the university can have all kinds of partnerships, ranging from exploring formal partnerships. A number of communities, Charlottesville and UVA included right now, for example, are going forward with proposals to Google. Google has announced a broadband initiative where their desire is to bring in very large bandwidths to individual homes, and they're looking for communities that have interesting strategic partnerships to bring to that. We participate at that level.
Yes, and there's also, I know there's a strong community movement of people working behind that. So are you, right. Is this a joint effort? Are you working with partners in town? And I know the mayor and the city council is behind this idea.
So the community is taking the lead on this, and we would love to see it happen. We're providing support for it as well.
Excellent.
But, you know, where I think one of the things that technology has done, and in some ways it goes to that consumerization point earlier, is that one of the things that technology has done is it's made it possible to do these large-scale distance collaborations around new forms of expression. So as the caller was indicating, doing multimedia projects focused on regions where people from all over the country can come in and participate via technology and create something together. You know, one of the things that technology has done is it's really exploded the scale of collaboration from your local community or your local lab or your local classroom to, in fact, the world, where the thing that binds people together is a common interest. The university is always, of course, interested in fostering collaborations around interesting artistic, intellectual, scholarly works.
All right. You're listening to James Hilton on The Wake Up Call. There are lots of radio stations, other music sources out there, but there's only one that brings you a program like the Sunday Morning Wake Up Show. And the only reason we can do this is because listeners like Katie Chester, Mike Jamerson, and Kathy Hinchey, all who supported it in WNRN's fund drive this past fall. It's also because of our program underwriters like the ones you're hearing from this hour, as well as Crutchfield and the Student Bookstore. So stay tuned and tell a friend about the Sunday Morning Wake Up Show and other programming you enjoy on WNRN, and be sure to support our next fund drive coming up on Monday. Support for NRN today is also coming from Blue Ridge Mountain Sports, with outdoor gear, clothing, and footwear for all your hiking, travel, and everyday needs. You'll find new products like North Face, Arc'teryx, Patagonia, and Mountain Hardware at Blue Ridge, along with Gore-Tex software from Keen, Merrill, and Vasque. That's Blue Ridge Mountain Sports in the Barracks Road Shopping Center, Charlottesville, at Winter Green, the Chesterfield Town Center, and West Broad Street, Richmond, and BRMS.com. All right, we're listening to James Hilton. If you're interested to talk to James, you can call in at 979-0919 or a toll-free number, 877-967-6762. That's star NRN on Intellis Wireless, or instant message at WNRNstudio@AOL. Okay, James, you talked at the beginning of the show about intellectual property. And I'd be curious to hear your view on how technology has changed intellectual property in the university setting and in education, particularly in the new media age where everything is free and everything is available at all times. What challenges does that present in a university setting?
Everything is free as long as you have an asterisk after free. Access to information, you know, one of the things that technology has done is it's made access to information virtually ubiquitous. So I can now get the information from my smartphone, from my home, from the university library. I have enormous ability to get to information. But what technology has really done is it's reignited, it was an old debate from the founding of the country, actually. It's ignited a debate over the rights, really, of users and authors, users and content owners. And if you think back 200 years ago, so the basic notion is that content, there are two interested parties around any content. There's the content owner, and there's the interest of the content reader or listener or user. And copyright intellectual property law has always tried to strike a balance between those two parties. you want, in fact, to provide enough protection for the owner that they can profit from their work, but you also want to provide access to users. You don't want authors to have exclusive control over who, for example, can read their stuff. So copyright law has always had a balance. And in the early days of copyright law, in the pre-technology days of copyright law, the balance was firmly on the side of users. It was the rare thing that was protected. It was protected for a very limited amount of time. And that protection was offered only as an incentive to get authors to create works. So one of the things that people often don't realize about copyright law is copyright law was actually the great original incentive for people to share. Copyright law protects the expression of an idea, but it doesn't protect the underlying idea. So I always think about romantic comedies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the basic plot line of a romantic comedy, not so novel from movie to movie. Two people meet, they're attracted to each other and simultaneously repulsed to each other. They are drawn. Something happens that pushes them both far away. In the absence, they realize that they really love each other and they come back together and there's always a dog in the final shot, right? And that's the sort of plot line. And copyright doesn't protect that.
Mm-hmm.
What it protects is the way Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan instantiate that, or the way Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn instantiate that. It protects the expression. It was from the beginning this notion that if you provide people with a protection around their expression of the work, they'll be motivated to express their ideas. And ideas can't be protected. Ideas, once they're made public, you can't put them back in a bottle. Jefferson compared them to candles, said, you know, the beauty about a candle is you can light your taper off of mine, your world's not diminished, and mine is enlightened. He said that's what ideas are, and copyright was a scheme to protect the expression, to get ideas to share. So copyright is really an incentive to get people to share.
Very nice Jefferson reference, by the way. Well done.
Thank you. I did it before I came to Virginia, for what it's worth. he was brilliant on this topic. You know, what technology, though, has now done is it's made it possible to profit for a very, very long time off of the expression of that work. And at the same time, technology makes it very, very hard technically to protect that content. There really is no digital rights management system that somebody with a really concerted effort can't overcome, can't break. So part of what's happened is you've seen a legal battle where increasingly there is a move to protect more and more the content. So yes, we right now experience the world as access to almost anything I want at no cost because there's an advertising economy that's supporting those works right now. It's not clear how long that's going to last. It's not clear whether this is I don't know that advertising can support everything forever and ever. But right now we experience it that way. At the same time, the legal framework is trying to give more and more power to content owners. So, you know, if you create a new work now, it's basically protected forever. And you or your heirs will have control over that work forever. And the places where I think that starts to really chafe a little bit is, I don't know if you've ever noticed, but when you go out to a restaurant and they sing happy birthday to somebody, you hardly ever hear them sing the happy birthday song we all associate with happy birthday. Instead, you hear them sing or chant some made up something.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? Well, it is that because happy birthday is still in copyright. And if a restaurant performs the song happy birthday, it's a performance and there are royalties that should be paid for that performance. So restaurants, particularly chains, find it easier to just not do happy birthday. At some point, you want to say, you know, happy birthday may still be in copyright, but it's part of our culture, and it seems to me that it's part of what we are and should be, and it's time for things like that to pass. And that's pass into the public domain, and that is where this tension is. How long should protection last? How should it? When should things pass over? And technology just acts as an accelerant on all that. It just makes the controversy has been there since 1776, actually 1790 was, I think, the first copyright statute.
So you've made distinctions between consumer software and enterprise software.
Mm-hmm.
And within enterprise software, you've also talked about essential and strategic technology.
Mm-hmm.
So talk a little bit about your job as CIO. What is what is the enterprise? What is enterprise software and applications? And where does it overlap with the consumerization as we're talking about bringing smartphones into schools? And also, what can the university provide? You know, 10 years ago, if you wanted an email address, the easiest way to get an email address was to be a UVA employee. Or if you wanted an internet connection, you had to come on grounds. Now, you know, in my neighborhood, I whip out my iPhone and I have to fight to connect to my own home wireless network because there are literally a dozen wireless networks within range of my house. And they all have names like Netgear and Default. So, and you also talked earlier about the initiative with Google providing high-speed internet to larger communities. So where does the university sit in the middle of that? And what are you giving up and what can you still provide that's unique in the academic environment?
Sure. Well, I would say I'm going to start with the first part of the question, which would be sort of how do I see my job in that space? Mm. In a nutshell, you know, I think that my job is to, in fact, recognize that budgets at university are going to be very constrained, and we have to find new things. We have to support new services, new techniques, new tools, and we have to do that within the context of a constrained budget. So I focus a lot of attention on distinguishing between what I think of as essential technology and strategic technology. Essential technology is technology that is, well, essential. You have to have it. It's like oxygen. Oxygen is essential to life. If you don't have it, it's really tough to keep going. And a lot of technology that used to be boutique is now essential. So the university runs on email and electronic communications. We run on enterprise data systems. In those senses, essential technology is a lot like power and water. You have to have them to operate. But there's this other sense in which technology is also what I think of as strategic. So strategic, the difference for me between essential and strategic is that strategic is something that gives you competitive advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, I mean it's something that goes to the core of the mission and business of the enterprise. So for universities, that is scholarship, research scholarship, teaching, and public service. So are there places where investments in technology directly have the potential to advance that? And it seems to me that there are places where that's true. And in fact, we are investing in that. So my goal is to find ways for the essential stuff, the stuff that is merely essential, meaning if you don't have it, it'll kill you, but you got to have it, is to in fact find ways to deliver the essential as inexpensively as possible, highest value. The good news is most things that have become essential and become ubiquitous have commoditized. They have gone down in price over time. So storage keeps going down in price. The price of compute cycles keeps going down, and they've standardized so that you really can say, I have a number of reasonable alternatives, and my goal is to lower the cost of delivering those. On the other hand, the strategic investments are investments where you don't know for sure that there's going to be a payoff, but if there's a payoff, it could pay off in a big way. So the most important, probably strategic investment that we've been making in technology at UVA over the last 3 years has been in supporting computationally intense science and scholarship. So helping scientists, humanists, social scientists, engineers to use advanced technology to take new looks at old and emerging questions. A great example from the humanities is if you're an architectural historian, you have lots of questions about what ancient Rome was like and how buildings were positioned and what you could see from what vistas and how that those vistas might in fact shape how the political economy grows.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Where people are matters in terms of the politics that emerge. One of the things that you can do now with 3D visualization technology and mapping is you can go back to architectural records, you can create advanced three-dimensional models. You can then go in and you can actually ask, so what could you see from this hill? What could the citizens of Rome have seen when they were in the Colosseum and what could they not have? And to the extent that those shape political movements, shape philosophy, then you get another insight into ancient Rome. And that's in the humanities. In the sciences, the sort of notion that advanced information processing is now how science is conducted is almost passé. But we have a huge challenge to invest in that, to support the scientists and scholars.
Were you talking about the Virtual Rome Project there?
I was.
Yeah. Yeah. Now that's in partnership with other universities, isn't it?
It is. And in fact, I would argue that one of the things that you find as you move into any technology-enabled discipline or scholarship is that it's more likely to involve multiple universities. You know, another thing that I think higher ed has to get over is one of the things that technology brings is that the right scale is a scale that is larger than any single university.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of times when I say that, people say, yes, but universities are in competition with each other. We compete for students. We compete for faculty. And all of that's true. But if, in fact, technology has this scale that is above the single university campus, then one of the things that you can start asking for is, so what kinds of collaborations do I want to pick and use? And so my pithy answer when people say, but universities compete, is to say they do compete, and I'm going to try to get competitive advantage by picking the right collaborations. I want to collaborate with the right scholars and the right institutions on the right problems to advance knowledge.
Well, the Virtual Rome, I picked up on that because my alma mater, UCLA, is one of the partners in that. Mm-hmm. And I was out there 2 years ago for an alumni weekend, and they brought us into a room was lined with HDTVs, and this was 2 years ago. I'm sure the technology has advanced even more since then. So it was like 200 degrees of screens, and then they launched Virtual Rome, and we did a fly through of ancient Rome, and then they switched. I think it was the Chicago Exposition of 1880 or something like that, and it was fantastic.
Right.
And I'm sure the detail then, you know, you could see, you know, bas reliefs on the walls, and you could see in the Chicago Exposition, you could see machinery working and pumps going up and down, and in the ancient Rome, you could see, you know, you could see the marbling on the walls and the columns, and I'm sure that has only built up since then. So this is a very exciting area, and you're right. I think only institutions, educational institutions like UVA, could really build on this, because it's in their interest to build this kind of understanding of history.
Right, and I think one of the things when you see the Rome Reborn Project, or you see some of the amazing technologies that are being used right now, it's tempting sometimes to conclude that it's just pretty eye candy. So, you know, mm-hmm. So when it's hard to do the Rome Reborn Project justice. Because it's not just a video, it's an actual 3D model,
right.
And you can go somewhere in Rome that no one has, in virtual Rome, that mm-hmm. no one's ever been before,
mm-hmm.
and it computes it on the fly. And it's not just that it's cool technology, it's again, if you accept the premise that place shapes politics, shapes social movements, then understanding place becomes really important. And one of the things that I love about being at UVA is people at UVA get that. Because it you don't have to be here very long before you really come to realize that UVA is a great university, and there are great universities all over the place and great towns, but the thing that is true about UVA is UVA could not have been born out of sight of Monticello.
It's the Wake Up Call. We're talking to James Hilton, Vice President and CIO at the University of Virginia. If you have questions for James, you can call 979-0919 or a toll-free number, 1-877-967-6762. That's star NRN on Intellis Wireless or instant message at WNRN Studio.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, it's not Rick. It's Sean McCord stepping in for Rick. The Hook, it's the annual fiction writing contest, and this year saw a record number of contributors. Two of the top three entries, selected by contest judge John Grisham, are first-time writers. An MC is struck by a monster truck at the JPJ Arena in front of hundreds of fans, but is reported to be on his way to a full recovery. And speaking of JPJ, Lady Gaga is gracing the arena with her unique brand of entertainment in September. Read My Poker Face and read The Hook on newsstands now. All right. James, you were talking earlier about essential and strategic technology, and you mentioned email as an essential technology, but isn't email free now. We I work at ITC, our central IT department, and we once estimated that essentially half the people in the Charlottesville area have a @virginia.edu address. So that is a huge number. And isn't this something that might better be leveraged in the consumer space?
Well, so in fact, we are leveraging it in the consumer space with accounts for students who come on now. You have to think about email as a couple of different ways. So there's the email that we have historically provided for students, and there's the email that we provide for faculty and staff. And for students, beginning about 2 years ago, we started a partnership with both Google and Microsoft to actually move the hosting of our student email off to them. And part of the logic was that, in fact, this was now an essential thing, that they were willing to do that at an incredibly attractive price to the university, which was basically free. And it allowed us to provide an email address for students for life without taking on a perpetual liability of how we meet and provision that. So we've been in partnership with them, and it's a great example of where we're trying to drive down the cost of provisioning essential services that have commoditized as efficiently as possible. For faculty and staff email, it's a little bit more complicated, because for faculty and staff email, for email that originates with the university and goes to students, you can think about that as we broadcast to students, and we could deliver that to any, it's like delivering it to their post office box. We could deliver it to any email address that they gave us. The advantage of partnering with Google and Microsoft is that it's less likely to get snapped up by spam filters if we have a partnership with them. But for faculty and staff email, that is the business of the university. It's not a broadcast. So when I write an email to the president, that is part of our business record. And so we haven't yet moved to sourcing faculty and staff email differently, mostly not because it's probably not, I don't know how many negatives I can get in there, not because we think that that there's a strategic advantage to hosting the email ourselves, but because there's some very pragmatic policy questions that we haven't answered yet about email that is, in fact, the business of the university. But again, I would say that in spirit, we are absolutely, I'm part of a group, a multi-institutional group right now that's looking at how could you do an RFP for faculty and staff email that would address all of the RFP as a request for proposals.
Right.
From vendors, how could we do that in ways that would address the privacy concerns, the policy concerns, the e-discovery concerns that are inherent now in the modern world of business communications?
So you mentioned you're on a multi-institutional group. So you've seen what other universities and colleges are doing. Are there things that other institutions are doing that you'd like to be doing here?
So the beauty about higher education is there are always things at some other university that we would like to be doing here.
Right.
I would love to find ways to push out a much more aggressive program that would bring faculty and students together around technology-enabled projects where they are partners from the beginning, where faculty essentially bring these habits of mind that universities strive to help people develop. So they bring this sort of knowledge navigation expertise, and students bring different perspectives, often a perspective informed by technology that's different from the perspective that faculty bring in. I'd love to find more ways to get active programs like that going on. I'd love to find ways to provide more resources to, again, computationally intense faculty, or faculty who don't even yet know that their discipline is becoming computationally intense, but it's happening. I always give text analysis as an example. You know, I don't know how text analysis, I'm not a text analyst, I'm a social psychologist, but I have to believe that when the 28 million volumes that Google has under contract to digitize and fully index, when you will be able to search the corpus for individual words in context, that text analysis has to change. How do we get more tools? So there are interesting things going on at all kinds of places. USC has an interesting project going on around new media and story and the role of technology in it. Indiana University has huge initiatives going on in supporting particularly the natural sciences with huge bandwidth and huge cycles. So we're always looking at what other universities are doing to find ways. But I have to say, I think that, you know, Virginia is potentially better positioned than almost any other university to get this. We are this unique combination of a research university with an uncommon commitment to the undergraduate experience. UVA is really known for the undergraduate experience that you get here. And finding ways to use technology to engage students and faculty jointly in knowledge discovery is a strength that I think we have that other places struggle for.
Well, okay, so you've talked a little bit about new and interesting technologies that are coming out at other universities. What new and interesting technologies is UVA bringing out now?
So I would say that we see our sweet spot right now as, I mean, the new technologies that are going to come out are coming out of the labs from across grounds, and that's not my main focus. My main focus is how do we, in fact, help people use technology mm-hmm. better than any other place? So we have one of the things that's been really exciting over the last few years is a growing group of faculty who are engaged in this question of how can technology shape scholarship in the humanities, research in the social sciences, research in engineering and the natural sciences. And we now have faculty groups that are leading that effort. On the humanities social science, there's a group called Shanti and led by David Germano. And they are, for example, over the next 3 months, we will be rolling out 5 new tools to support humanities, social science, scholarship, and classrooms. So a blogging tool, a mm-hmm. wiki tool, a rich media editing relevant to the caller earlier, a rich media editing, online editing tool, bibliography tool, annotation tool, tools that traditional scholars find increasingly useful in the world today. On the natural science and engineering side, we have a group called UVAX, which is really focused on connecting people with the hardware resources that they need. If you need tons and tons of cycles, it turns out nationally there's a glut of cycles available, so they will connect you with national resources, but also connect you with technical expertise to help you frame your problems, recast your problems in ways that take advantage of technology. So they have examples. They send tiger teams out to work with faculty on constructing their problems for advanced computation. And there are instances in which they've been able to reduce the amount of time that it takes to solve a problem by traditional methods versus massively parallel intense computing ways, where they literally increase the speed to solution by 40-fold. So what I think of as UVA's sweet spot is we actually want to be the place that figures out how to use the technology and apply the technology to the classroom and the lab better than anybody else.
You're listening to James Hilton, Vice President and CIO at the University of Virginia. Today's programming on WNRN is being brought to you with the support of Blue Ridge Graphics at Meade Avenue and East High Street in Charlottesville, providing custom T-shirts and sportswear plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and at brgtshirts.com. And I see Drew Thompson is in the studio at noon. Join Drew Thompson for Les Temps Perdue. If French isn't your thing, that means the time's gone by. And on WNRN, that means late 80s through mid-90s alternative. Tune in today at noon. That's Les Temps Perdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music. Okay, so here's a tough question. We've talked about what the university is doing today and some of the new initiatives. And I'm going to ask you, what do you think IT will be like at the university in 5 to 10 years? And I ask that knowing that 5 years ago, if we had this discussion, if you had said you were rolling out a wiki, which is a space for a collaborative document where anyone or at least authorized people can go in and edit a document and build on it. But if we had talked about that 5 years ago, wiki would have sounded like an exotic drink. So realizing that the technology that we're going to be using 5 years from now maybe hasn't been invented yet, or at least hasn't been brought together in a way that's recognizable. Knowing that, still, it's part of your job to look to the future. So what do you see happening in technology at the university, and maybe even in a broader sense, in, say, the next 5 to 10 years?
That is a tough one. So I think that so I'll go with the big answers first.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be an exciting place. It's going to be a place that's going to be undergoing continual change. I think that one of the things that's hard for people to grasp is the pace of change in technology. So in 1990, if you'd wanted to buy a terabyte of magnetic spinning disk storage,
right,
that would have cost you well over $1 million.
I remember trying to budget for that.
And today you can go buy a terabyte for less than $100 at Best Buy.
Mm-hmm.
The pace of change is just relentless. 20 years ago, the internet, for all intents and purposes, didn't exist. The World Wide Web 20 years ago certainly didn't exist. And today it's a vital part of everything that we do. So change, it's not like this is a phase that we're going through and everything's going to calm down and return to normal. It's going to be a world of continuous change. The hope that I have is to sort of end where we started, is that technology has – I was at a talk on Friday by David Pink, a noted author and observer, and he made the point that in many ways the technology of the 20th century was aimed at taking the load off of our backs. And the technology of this century is a technology that's aimed at taking a load off of our brains. And where I think the exciting part is going to be for education is going to be finding ways to get technology to help us do those algorithmic, just sort of not very interesting mental tasks that we all have to do. It's going to help us do that faster. It's going to help us find ways to deliver information that today is often delivered in lecture formats. It's going to find ways to deliver that more efficiently so that we can use the classroom, particularly in a residential-based education like UVA, with a focus on research. It's going to create a world where we, in partnership with students from day one, can be engaged in the discovery of new knowledge, knowledge that can change the world, not simply in remembering, learning the facts of the past. And that world, I think, is going to be very exciting and probably 50 years from now, virtually unrecognizable.
Wow. Okay. So last question, because we have a little over a minute left, and I warned you this question was coming, but you've made your ubiquitous Thomas Jefferson references throughout our talk. So if Jefferson were still around today, what would he be doing in IT?
So I think the first thing that would be a safe bet is he would be buying almost every gadget out there and probably be broke by doing that. He was a gadget freak.
So he would have already ordered his iPad at 8:32 this morning.
He would have done that, I think. I think that's safe to say. But, you know, more seriously, I think that Jefferson would be embracing the challenges and opportunities that technology is bringing to higher education. You know, UVA, it was, in fact, a redefinition of education for the new world. That's what he wanted to set in place. He didn't actually, you know, Jefferson, I don't think, set out to create a university with 10 schools and a football stadium. What he set out to do was to create a new approach to education. And I think that to the extent that technology is enabling new approaches, he'd be all for it.
All right, James, thank you very much. This has been great. This has been an engaging conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as well. The show will be up on the Seaville podcast website this afternoon. So if you miss portions of it or if you just want to listen again, you can do so on the podcast. I'm Sean McCord. Rick Moore will be back next week. Thank you very much.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The wake-up call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.